That was John Kirby and his band, a recording of Temptation. 3:12, this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. With me is one of America's best-known and most-liked cartoonists, Jules Feiffer. The subjects of his cartoons have run the gamut from depression to sex to presidential elections. But Feiffer is known also for his movies and plays and books, as well as his cartoons. There was his movie Carnal Knowledge, for which he's now contemplating a sequel called Sex in America. He wrote the screenplay for Little Murders, which he adapted from his successful stage play of the same name. His play Hold Me has played in New York and toured through various parts of the country, including Philadelphia. And he's written the screenplay for the movie Popeye, which is going to star Robin Williams as Popeye and Shelley Duvall as Olive Oil. Feiffer has also written a few books. His newest is in the form of a comic strip novel. It's called Tantrum. It's the story of a married 42-year-old man who has two teenage children. He's so disgusted with all the responsibilities that he has to cope with every day that he decides to become a 2-year-old. As he becomes transformed into a 2-year-old's body, his wife and teenage kids look on in horror, and he says, quote, "I, your father, have reverted to the age of 2. That happens to be my private and personal choice. I will love and support you every bit as strongly as when I was middle-aged. That's all that matters as far as you're concerned. My age is my business." The book Tantrum is published by Knopf. Welcome, Jules Feiffer.
It's nice to be here.
Have you really wished to become two yourself?
Every moment.
Why?
Particularly when I'm running around plugging a book. I think it's pretty common in most adult lives, especially adults who are trapped into patterns of responsibility, where there are families to take care of, where there are agents to take care of, producers to take care of, directors to take care of, where you're running a life where you are simply continually in relationships which are collaborative and have responsibilities to, at one point or another, want to duck out on all of them, want to disappear. And one of the, you know, the common fantasy that many people have is just to become invisible or to get on the next plane, to run away to a South Sea island. And part of that fantasy, or I think at the core of it, is the desire to escape it all by becoming helpless again, by becoming passive, to retreat into infancy. And Tantrum is a response to my own urge to do that, maybe at least 3 or 4 times a day, or maybe 3 or 4 times a week. And what I suspect to be other people's urges. And since the book has come out, I've discovered that the response of men is, they say the book is about them, and of women, they say the book is about my husband.
Mm. I've wanted to become a cat or a dog, I think, more frequently than I've wanted to become a 2-year-old. Because they get to just lie around, eat lunch or dinner every now and then.
And you get scratched behind the ear.
And then just
lie
around again. Mm. Yeah. Would you really want to become a child? How happy was your childhood? Looking back in real life for a minute.
Well, I think that the nostalgia most people have for their past is not their real past, but their MGM past. It's that mythical suburb of the mind that they all live in, but they never really lived in. Because most childhoods are full of all sorts of conflict. And the passivity that one yearns for was really hated as a kid. You want to be free. You want to, you know, it's part of it has to do with the fact that there's never an age where you are exactly what you want to be. That when you're dependent, you don't want to be. When you're independent, you don't want to be. And Leo in Tantrum complains about that very point. He says that at one point in the book, when he's trying to get as a baby, trying to get back into his mother's house, and she won't let him because she won't acknowledge that he's regressed it too. And he complains how when he was raised, all he wanted to do was get out, and now he is out, and he's free and is independent. And what good is independence if you're not free to go back?
When you're a kid, all your imperfections are even more terrible to cope with, I think, than when you're an adult, because you can't have any sense of individuality or that it's okay to be different. It's actually terrifying each time you notice something about yourself that's different than your friends.
You've got no past and no background that allows you to make comparisons. One of the advantages in latter life crises, anything past adolescence, is that there's a sum of knowledge that you simply don't have as a kid.
You've watched your daughter grow up. She's, 15 now?
Yes, 15 and a half.
Do you compare your childhood or your early teenage years with hers at all?
It's hard to know. First of all, she's a girl. She's living in a very different time. And she's also, as of now, moving away from me so that I don't know a lot of what goes on with her. You know, she's from being very open started to be a little somewhat removed. So that I'm becoming aware of cover stories, and there's a CIA of the teenager that goes on continually, and I can't keep up with it, and I don't know how to deal with it.
Did you think it would be different when you became a father?
I hoped it would be different. I hope we'd be a very happy couple, father and daughter, walking off into the sunset together. But she's taking her walk alone with somebody else, and I don't know who or what it is.
I think a lot of people always ask you this, but I'll ask it anyway. Since so many of your cartoons deal with the neuroses and anxieties that most people have every morning when they wake up and then as their day continues, do you find yourself coping with a lot of anxieties and neuroses?
Oh, I think I used to. I'm not aware of it as much as I used to be. And I think over the years, not that you ever cure anxieties and neuroses, but you learn to live with them and you learn to handle them and you learn to be contemplative with them. I mean, they become part of your everyday existence to a point where they're more or less pacified, except when they get unpacified. And then I go crazy.
Well, since so many of your characters have it, I wonder what expectations are of you, like when you're meeting people for the first time. I wonder if people pay close attention to your behavior to see if you start doing the dance of spring or anything one of your characters might
do. I'm very careful never to meet anybody for the first time.
that's a good policy. Really, though, do you feel that people watch you closely in that
regard? I think there was that feeling many years ago when I began the strip. I used to go to parties, and I'm talking about the late 50s and early 60s now, and people would say, I'm afraid to open my mouth around you. I might end up in the cartoon. Ha, ha, ha. And which would annoy the devil out of me because I never went places to do work or observe people or to make them the object of my searing perception. I went to enjoy myself and meet girls the way everybody else was trying to meet girls, things like that. But I don't sense that attitude very much anymore, and I don't think it's the general attitude toward me. I mean, I find that that's changed over the years, that people don't think anymore that I'm watching them to get something on them. The ones who have read and followed me over the years really seem to think more warmly and responsively toward me, because at various times through their lives, I've been their spokesman.
What has your experience with success been? Do you find that being as popular and successful as you've been has relieved stress in your life or has created more tensions?
Oh, it's been terrific in that being very ambitious as a kid, being very ambitious all my life, I wanted very, very much to be successful and to be famous. And when I began the cartoon, that was one way of becoming successful and famous and the way I wanted it to happen because I always wanted to be a cartoonist. But I was so busy being ambitious that it took a lot of the concentration away from the work itself. Not that I couldn't concentrate on it, but it seemed to me it was much more narrowly defined. And once I became successful and well-known, I could work on becoming an artist. I mean, I could concentrate on what I was doing. I could concentrate on refining the work so that despite the fact that the audience seemed very satisfied with it, I became less and less satisfied and tried to perfect it more and more. And you can't tell which ways you want to perfect it until you're into it. But it allowed me to refine it. It also allowed me to risk failure in other areas. It seemed to me that the great advantage of being a famous cartoonist was then I could become a playwright with some equanimity. I could get my plays read and have a chance at getting them on a lot faster than other people simply because I was known. It wouldn't get them produced if people didn't like them, but I could get an immediate reading where someone else would have to wait months. And I could risk failure in all sorts of areas because I had the continual success of the cartoon in front of everybody's eyes week after week after week. And so failing in one area or another was never a problem for me because the cartoon was always there. So it's been marvelous in that it's allowed me to take all sorts of chances that I don't think I would have had the courage to take otherwise.
You've been cartooning throughout the 1970s and earlier than that. Are there things that, now that the decade is wrapping up, typify the 1970s for you?
Yes, they never happened. I mean, I think the 70s was really a traumatic reaction to the 60s, and to that extent, people have been in retreat. It's the country has partly because of the post-Watergate atmosphere and the Vietnam trauma, has fragmented and dissolved to a point where you go out in the street looking for the United States of America. I mean, it's pretty pathetic when people say the nice thing about Iran is that it's unified the country. But because what that tells us is that there wasn't a country out there, and it takes something awful like this to raise people's instincts and unify them, and only unifies them in a rather ugly way, in a gung-ho way. Let's go get those no goods.
Oh, what about emotionally? Things that typify the 70s.
I think emotionally we've been withdrawn. It's people have been cool. It's the disco decade. It's laid back, uninvolved. People don't want to get hurt, and they discover if they get involved, they get hurt. If they get politics, they get hurt. If they get committed, they get hurt. Women by men's lights have made alarming progress, meaning that the men can no longer have things the automatic way they once had them. So the men can get hurt, so they go numb. The women entering new areas for the first time in their lives discover all sorts of new vulnerability they didn't expect, so they lay low emotionally. And everyone is, it seems to me, discovering the remarkable sets of problems that every new step of change and every new step of liberation brings, so that the sexual revolution, instead of improving sex, has made pornography almost as puritanical as the Victorianism that preceded it, in that rather than making sex attractive, it makes it repellent. It makes it ugly. I think we're in a state of phased withdrawal from the kind of life we once led and moving into some other existence, and we haven't figured out or plotted the shape of that existence yet.
Do you spend much time on or around college campuses?
I used to. I haven't in a year or two because I've been so busy working on other things, but I used to tour and lecture at colleges a lot.
What have your impressions been the last times that you
were
around?
Well, this goes back about 2 years, and I thought it was interesting because it seemed to me that kids were reading again and going after grades again, that there was a conservative bent that people were talking about, and I didn't think it was a return to the 50s as was at that time being talked about. I thought that it was a part of this laying low. There was the 50s, there was a kind of smugness and sanguinity on the part of students. They knew that they were going to get out of college and have an assured future. Nobody believes that anymore. And for the first time, we have a generation of middle and upper class kids who are going to school with no assurance that they're going to have a profession when they get out, that there will be work for them when they get out. That's all new stuff.
It's a lot of young people on campuses who seem to be turning towards religion, either the one they were born into or another one. Have you noticed that?
Yes, and it's part of the new dopiness.
The new what?
The new dopiness. And it really has to do with fear, insecurity, anxiety, no sense of a future, no belief in the political system, no belief in the country's ability to keep you going, no belief in the family. I mean, all of the institutions that were once very strong have dissolved, not been replaced by anything. And so, unfortunately, we're not allowed somehow or other a cultural atheism or societal atheism. People, for one reason or another, need something to believe in. And if it's not, and if it's not tangible, if they can't invent it, they go crazy. So they have to invent something. And so they invent one form of fundamentalism or another, one kind of true belief or another, from Mooneyism to Jim Jonesism to Scientology to Buddhism, whatever it is, a return to the more fundamental and older faiths, whether it's Orthodox Judaism or Catholicism or whatever it is. Rather than being an evangelical spirit, it seems to me that is of a positive note, it really has to do with, I can't stand it, and I got to find something. I got to find something outside of me. And obviously one must find something outside of themselves, but to use these true beliefs as a form of withdrawal rather than a movement ahead, co-committing with the return to a functioning kind of fundamentalism is the institutionalization of racism in the society, where we no longer are horrified by the inequalities in the society, but rather we talk about life being unfair, to parrot Jimmy Carter. Or we talk about how you can't throw dollars at problems, to parrot Nixon. And it's interesting how the code language has changed, so that at one time, something called the poverty program, which was nothing more or less than throwing dollars at problems, was considered a good thing. Now, when there's a kind of scorn and contempt when you talk about throwing dollars at problems, then where do we throw the dollars? We throw them at the army. We throw them into the MX missile. We throw them to the Chrysler Corporation, but we don't throw them to the poor.
Do you ever look back on your cartoons of 10 years ago and compare what you were thinking and writing about then with what you're thinking and writing about now, and how the nature of things seems to have either changed or remained the same?
Well, it has changed. I don't have to look back because these periods in my life are all very clear to me and always stay in my head. They never leave, so that the 50s remains very much a part of what I do in the 70s and will do in the 80s as the 60s and 70s do. It's odd how things seem to fall into decades, but they do, even when it isn't true that they operate that way.
Has your personal life fallen into decades in that way, too?
I don't think so, no.
Your personal opinions? Do you find your politics changing with the decades, and as you get older, attitudes changing at all?
I don't think so very much. I don't think so very much. I mean, there's a scale from left to right that I move automatically, and there are periods when I'm more conservative and there are periods when I'm more radical, but it's a very narrow range. It's pretty much the same.
How are you going to deal with Iran? Have you done any cartoons about that yet? I looked at The Voice. We get it in Philadelphia a little later, and wasn't sure if I'd see something on Iran in there or not, and it was on the presidential elections.
Yeah, I got my first cartoon on Iran that'll come out in The Voice this week and be in the Inquirer a little later. I find it very hard to deal with because my instincts are to go along with everybody. I mean, you know, I'm just as mad as anybody else is and just as upset, and therefore I see no point in parroting everyone else. If I can't think of another line on it, then I see no reason to do it. So I really haven't done anything that I'm crazy about on Iran. I've done one thing, and it's okay.
It's a real hot issue. Do you have to approach that differently?
No, I don't think you approach it. I just want to... No, I approach it only from the point of view of, can I say something about this that no one else has said, and therefore it's worth saying. It's the same thing with Cambodia. I don't know what to say about Cambodia that hasn't already been said, and yet I feel compelled to do something on it. But what I'm afraid what I'll do will be very ordinary. And simply artistically, I'm not satisfied with that. But one has to comment. And the same thing is true of Iran. So I'm afraid my comment may be quite inadequate, but as good as I can do at the moment.
Do you have a quota for yourself on the proportion of politically oriented cartoons to emotionally oriented cartoons that you want to produce?
Well, it used to change. I used to do 2 and 2 and then 1 out of 3. And now I don't have any quota at all. Sometimes there are phases where they're not political at all, and then 6 or 7 weeks will be political. I've just begun in the autumn of this year a series which runs intermittently every several. I try to do one a month or so of a pair of hitchhikers, a young boy and girl, and who comment on everything in life and have this ongoing relationship, always on the road day or night, never getting a ride and just talking to each other. And I'm having great fun with that, and that's really what I'm enjoying most in the cartoon right now.
If you don't mind, Jules Pfeiffer, I'd like to introduce a project that I know is occupying part of your time now, and that's the movie of Popeye, for which you've written the screenplay. Is it too soon to talk about this at all?
No.
You just got back from Malta, where it's being shot?
Malta is where it's being shot,
yeah. Why is it being shot in Malta?
Damned if I know.
Is it cheaper there?
It's cheaper
perfect
there,
scenery?
And Robert Altman, who's directing it, has built an incredible shanty town on a place called Anchor Bay, and there's this marvelous-looking cove, and up from the cove there are these sheer cliffs, and on the cliffs there's this incredible shantytown he's built that looks like it's 200 years old and about to fall apart, and that's where Popeye and Olive Oil and her family are going to live.
Did you love Popeye when it was the cartoon?
Well, there were two different Popeyes, and people tend to forget that. There was the original comic strip created by E.C. Segar in the 1930s, And then there were the animated cartoons that a couple of generations of kids, or maybe more than that, have grown up seeing. And the original Seagar material is simply brilliant stuff, and quite as brilliant in the 30s as the kind of work that Groucho was doing, or W.C. Fields was doing in films. And nobody knows about that, because very little of that material has ever been reprinted. A couple of books have come out, and brilliant collections. And I based much of the screenplay on what I read in a published version of the 1936 Popeyes, and really just tried to translate Seagar's characters in his work into solid, better structured movie terms.
I grew up watching Popeye, not watching it that much really, but there were certainly plenty of Popeye cartoons on when I was a kid. And Popeye and Olive Oil both used to really mystify me, because there was this ever-present sense of sexuality between them. On the other hand, they were two of the weirdest-looking characters you'd ever want to see. And there was something so asexual about Olive Oil. On the other hand, she was always being kidnapped by someone and tied up, and there was always a sense of bondage that you'd get from watching a Popeye strip, and I never quite understood what was happening there.
Well, I think that was true of the animated cartoons. Olive is a much more likable, more original and quirky character in the original strip. And that's the Olive I try to capture. You know, she's ferociously independent and ferociously wants to be taken care of. She's bad-tempered and sweet at the same time. She's a marvelous, complicated, interesting character. And Popeye is, unlike the animated cartoons, the single, honest, moral character in a totally corrupt world. And rather than this making him pompous and boring, he enters into such marvelous self-righteousness that it becomes vastly entertaining. And the bad guys are never that bad. I mean, their badness is always very amusing. There was a kind of civility and good temper about the world of Seagar that never got translated into the animated cartoons. And it's this tone of civility and good temper that I've tried to bring off in the screenplay.
What about spinach? Is there spinach?
Oh yeah,
in it?
There'll be the spinach we hold off to the end, and it's the Rains in Spain number, the big climax of the movie.
It's a musical?
It's a musical. Yeah, Harry Nilsson is writing the music, Altman's directing it, and in addition to Robin and Shelley, Paul Dooley is playing Wimpy, and it's I love the what's going on so far about it. We start shooting in January.
Okay, well, I wish you the best with that movie and with all your other projects and your regular cartooning. Jules Pfeiffer, it's really been a pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's been very nice. Thank you.
I've been speaking to Jules Pfeiffer. I'm sure you've seen his cartoons. He has a new book out now, and it's, well, it's in the form of a comic strip novel. It's comics, but it's lots and lots of pages, and it's a story that gets followed through from beginning to end. It's a story that develops, basically about a 42-year-old father with two teenagers. He's married, and he's so fed up with responsibility that he becomes a two-year-old, transforms himself into a two-year-old, and that's where the book begins. Jules Pfeiffer, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Judy Stein, Fresh Air's arts reviewer, will be with us in a minute.
$2, which you owe me.
Listen, Sam, I'm going to pay you them $2, but I can't pay you now. I'll pay you tomorrow.
That's what you said.
Well, now, listen, Sam, ain't we been dubbed long, long time?
Yes, we have.
And ain't we been sticking together through thick and thin?
Yeah, that's just the reason I'm...